a green, fully formed orb, and then Ruaho, the fierce red god. Naught but a red sliver on this particular night. Regardless, neither moon was willing to do more than cast a shaky pathway of light in the wrong direction. Grey tried to keep his bearings, but soon became disoriented as exhaustion and fatigue set in. He stopped swimming, uncertain as to whether he was moving west, east, north, south, or, more likely, in circles. His vision began to blur, and the thought of sleep was a powerful rope gripping him, pulling him, tempting him. "Can't sleep," he thought. Sleep was death. "I'll just close my eyes for a few moments. Rest them." He did, and it felt so good. The ocean was gentle now, rocking him, caressing his ears with a sweet lullaby. When he opened his eyes, he could see a face, distant at first, and then moving closer. It was familiar, her smile like a golden sunrise, her eyes like the bottoms of blue crystal decanters. Princess Rhea smiled at him, and he wanted to smile back, but his lips were too weary. He pulled back in horror as her lips turned to snakes, her teeth to fangs, her eyes to red beads ringed with fire. He screamed, but his cry was lost in the water, which was all around his face, stinging his eyes, infiltrating his nose, his mouth. His head burst from the water and he coughed, choking for a while until the ocean was expelled from his lungs. "I fell asleep," he realized. His vision of Rhea was a nightmare, and he'd sunk under the water and... "Shay!" For a moment he felt sheer panic, but it quickly subsided when he saw her. His sister, somehow, some way, was lying on her back, floating nearby. She was still asleep, her face as peaceful as a moonbeam. Shaking the cobwebs away, Grey kicked over to her. She stirred when he tucked his hand under her knees and his stump behind her head, using his legs to tread water. Her eyes fluttered open, blinking several times before focusing on him. A smile creased her lips. "Grey," she said. Her eyes closed and she slept once more. Grey stayed like that for a long time, watching his sister sleep. Though they were miles away from shore and might not even survive the night, he wasn't sad or scared or lonely. No, they were together again, and that was all that mattered. He kept his sister afloat for as long as he could bear, until weariness took him and his eyelids refused to obey any longer, until his mind and the world spun in tandem, until an enormous shadow descended o'er him and he knew death had found them both, until he found himself sinking, 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 the water closing over his chin, his lips, his nose, his eyes, his head, until the angels of mercy murmured from the heavens and reached down their strong arms and scooped his soul up, lifting him higher, 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 to the sky above. And in the end, he smiled.
36. The Southern Empire, the Skara Desert. Raven Sands. Gota was still apologizing profusely as they departed Kesh.
"She was with me for nigh on 2 years," he said. "She gave no indication of violence."
Raven whirled around and squeezed the man's arm.
"We know. It's not your fault. You bear no blame."
His quick-to-smile lips were pulled into a tight line, his eyes fierce.
"I have heard of those who cried tears of joy when they spotted Kesh in the distance, only to find it was a trick of the light, a desert mirage. Those men and women died wishing they'd found this place. Then there are others who could see our oasis, but fell before they made it. But thousands of others have eaten with us, slept in our huts, cooled themselves under our palms. We are a single candle of hope in an infinite sea of sand. Our reputation is everything, and we have failed the most important women in the Four Kingdoms."
You couldn't have known what that woman would do. When questioned, Gouta had been forthcoming. The would-be assassin's name, at least according to her, was Barge,
and she'd been nothing but an excellent employee of Guta's ever since she'd arrived, almost 2 years earlier, requesting a job. And yet, she'd tried to stab fire through the eye in the dead of night. Guta said,
"I will release my entire household and begin anew. Each new employee will be screened by my most trusted advisers in Calip. I will earn back the trust I have lost."
"That's really not necess—" Fire appeared just then, leading her Guanik, and Raven stopped at the look in her sister's eyes. Stalwart. Weary, but alive. Fearless, despite what she told Raven only a day earlier.
"I feel as if an Arrak is nipping at my heels, and if I don't keep moving, it will eat me alive."
Raven had made a joke in response, not taking her sister's words seriously enough.
She knew, Raven thought. Somehow she knew.
A roiling stew of guilt churned in Raven's gut. She was the one who'd convinced Fire to stay another night, despite her sister's instincts. She was the one who'd almost gotten her killed.
"Guta," Fire said now, "thank you for your hospitality. It is unmatched in all of the South."
Guta offered a short bow.
"A full investigation will be conducted. I am sorry for—"
"Enough," Fire said.
"Your apologies are as unnecessary as they are sincere. I trust whatever actions you decide to take, but know that I believe Kesh will continue to be a torch of safety and hope in the Skara." Guta opened his mouth to speak again, but Fire raised a hand.
"Say no more. You have my blessing as we depart rested and replenished."
Finally, a thin smile found its way back onto the small man's lips, though it didn't carry the genuineness it had when they first arrived. The Guanero gathered in a protective circle around Fire and Raven as they mounted up and rode back out into the desert.
"I should have trusted you," Raven said. "You have. You are here, by my side. But I advise you to linger when you believed riding on was the better option. Just because my paranoia was validated by the assassin doesn't mean it wasn't paranoia. That woman could have attempted to take my life the first night, had she wanted to. If not for Goggin refusing to leave her side, she might have."
Goggin overheard his name.
"I should have throttled her rather than spun her," he said, shaking his head.
"Stop. Both of you. You're as bad as Guta," Fire said. "Like him, you couldn't have known what she would do."
"But you did," Raven insisted.
"I didn't. I only had a sinking feeling in my stomach. But I've had it since I made the decision to ride to war."
Raven recalled what her sister had said about feeling like she was born to be a weapon and nothing more. Those words, even if they were wrong, made Raven want to protect her younger sister, the same way she'd always protected Whisper. The sun goddess stretched above them and they rode on, due west, carried on an endless tide of sand. The wind, thankfully, was at their backs.
"You saved my life," Fire said a while later. "I'm a light sleeper."
"So am I, but I didn't awaken." Raven shrugged. "You're my baby sister, so I'm obligated to protect you. And you happen to be the Empress, so as an honorary member of the Guanero, I am sworn by oath to save your life if I have the opportunity." Fire's lip twitched.
"Oh, really? So it was just duty that drove your valor?
And Whisper would never forgive me if I let you die on my watch." Fire's smile faded.
"Gods, what are we going to do with her?"
"Survive," Raven said. "Protect her from this world. Defeat Fata and defend our borders. And what of the east and west and north? Long have they coveted the south. Eventually they will come, whether it's the ironclads crossing Dragon Bay, or the Lorenz from the Burning Sea, or the Gaeriks sailing down the Spear. The Skara can only protect us for so long. By then, our dragons will be full size. Our enemies will flee from us in fear. And if they don't, they will burn." Fire nodded at that. Burning was one thing she understood all too well. They rode on for a while longer without speaking, though it was a comfortable silence, as only one can be between sisters. Fire finally said,
I fear the assassin was one of our own.
Raven flinched at the notion.
You mean a Calypsian?
Fire nodded.
There are those who long to sit on the Southron throne, to usurp the power our family has held for many generations. They could have assassins in various places, where we'd least expect it, lying in wait. That woman was in Kesh for nearly 2 years, biding her time on the slim chance that I might eventually pass through the desert. Our enemies are as patient as spiders.
Raven said.
She had the Calypsian look, but she couldn't have been paid by anyone.
Even Fata?
No,
Raven replied quickly.
He wouldn't. Not like that. He will protect his lands, his way of life, but he won't murder his own daughter in cold blood.
Raven hated the doubt in her own voice, hated that the man she'd grown up with had become a monster in her eyes. For the next 3 nights they marched until both moons were high overhead, casting dueling swords of light across the desert. They slept briefly, rising before Surai rose from the west. No one grumbled or complained, not even Goggin, nor Raven, though she could see the weariness creeping along the ragged line of soldiers behind them. When they did stop, everyone went straight to sleep, having filled their bellies during the march. As the heat wore them down and sand coated their tongues and lips, few words were spoken, save from Goggin, who seemed so steadfastly upbeat that Raven began to wonder whether he'd snuck some simpra into his waterskin. On the fourth day, Goggin looked up and said,
"The spear!"
Raven followed his gaze past the hundreds of dunes to a distinct line of silver in the distance. She thought it could be a trick of the desert light.
"Are you certain?"
"Twice I have seen this sight," he said. "I am as certain as anyone can be of visions in the desert."
Still, Raven dared not hope, not until they were closer. Fire said nothing, but from that point her eyes were trained forward, fixed on that shimmering line. Goggin was right. The dunes became smaller and thinner until they fell away completely, giving way to hard-packed dirt and then tufts of brittle, brown grass. And then, abruptly, there was green grass and small three-leafed plants. The sound of burbling water arose as the river fully came into view. The spear was aptly named, its slow-moving water a straight, narrow shaft of blue that shot northward, toward Hyro Lake and southward, where its tip would eventually pierce the heart of the burning sea. The Guanic didn't need further urging as they sped up, pushing for the promise of water. When they arrived at the riverbank, the Guanera dismounted and stripped down to their underclothes, bathing and laughing in the water, while their coarse-skinned mounts drank voraciously. Goggin entertained his men and women by launching himself off the land, landing in the water with a thunderclap that left a red mark on his chest. For the first time since they'd left Kesh, Raven felt a swell of joy in her heart, though it was short-lived when she saw Fire standing on the riverbank, looking past the water to a barren land of red rocks and cracked earth. At the edge of the land something rose up like a mountain, running east to west, blocks of stone so large that it was beyond Raven's comprehension as to how they'd been stacked atop one another. It was a marvel akin to the pyramids of Calypso. Despite the bounty of clean blue water running before her feet, Fire was already looking ahead to the Southron gates. Although Raven could see the impatience in Fire's eyes, an ever-burning flame, not unlike the burning tree within their palace in Calypso, her sister was wise enough to allow her army a full day's rest and leisure on the flanks of the spear. Men and women lounged on the banks of the river, cleaning the sand from their leather armor and skin, sharpening their weapons, massaging their sore muscles. Slowly, grim expressions turned to smiles, especially when Goggin stomped through the sea of soldiers, slapping backs and shouting words of encouragement. They'd conquered the Skara, and he was determined to give them their moment of victory. In truth, Raven knew they'd been lucky, their journey blessed by the desert god, whose name they did not speak. He had held back the great sandstorms to let them pass. His scorpions and pisons had mostly stayed away. All told, only 8 had perished on the windswept dunes. and four of those were their reptilian mounts. 4 soldiers out of 3,000, Raven mused. It was an enormous victory indeed, one worth celebrating. When Goggin approached her, Raven said, "Thank you."
"For what?"
"For encouraging the soldiers. For being a spark of light in the dark." Goggin snorted.
"I fear your words are far too poetic for a simple man of few talents like me. I am only as loud and boisterous as I am to distract from my many faults."
"And yet you are loved by many."
"Most women are afraid I might eat them."
Raven shook her head. "You sell yourself short."
"There's nothing short about me."
Fire joined the conversation. "You are good at breaking things," she noted.
"Much to my mother's chagrin when, as an oversized youth, I tripped and knocked over her fine clay dishes,"
Goggin said. "Tomorrow that will come in handy when we shatter the gates."
"Indeed. I will aim my clumsiness at the wall and hope it breaks before my skull."
Fire laughed. "The human battering ram. That should be your nickname."
"Beats Goggy. That's what my sister used to call me before she could pronounce Goggin."
"I wouldn't say that too loud," Raven said, "or the Guanero will grab onto it and never let you hear the end of it."
"That's where you're wrong," Goggin said. "They already know about that old nickname, but the last time one of them used it, he ended up dangling from his feet with his head halfway down my guanic's throat. No one's repeated it since."
Though Raven wasn't sure whether the large man was japing or not, it was a stark reminder that the happy-go-lucky commander of the Guanero was a warrior at heart, capable of fierce bouts of violence when necessary. Like Fire had said, they would need him and his warriors on the morrow. They crossed the river during the dark pre-dawn threads, knitted together like a grey blanket across the spear. Though the Guanic were heavy beasts, they floated as well as wood, carrying their riders easily against the current with their powerful, churning legs. The rest of the army swam, carrying their leather armour and weapons above their heads and kicking ferociously. When they'd all forged the river, the tiniest sliver of sunlight peeked over the horizon. The Southron gates, however, were cast in an ominous shadow, making them appear as an enormous slumbering beast, a pison perhaps, without beginning nor end. Would it swallow them whole? Raven wondered darkly. She shook her head. It was a foolish thought, for the Southron gates were intended to keep intruders from the north from invading Fanes. As Fire had cleverly realized, an attack from the south would be completely unexpected. The element of surprise would serve them well on this day. Like an army of ghosts, they crept northward, hugging the edge of the river. No one spoke, the only sounds whispered by the river and the gentle scrape of leathers against steel. The lights of the easternmost Phoenician war city, Susa, twinkled to the west, far enough away that they were not an immediate threat, though Raven knew, once the attack began, that enemy soldiers would pour forth, charging for the gates. Raven tried not to think about that. The immediate concern was reaching the wall with minimal casualties. The eastern edge of the great southern wall rose up like a black cliff. Atop the wall, backlit human slashes patrolled, looking northward, oblivious to the silent invaders sneaking up from behind. In the event of an assault by the west, the Phoenicians would shoot flaming arrows, catapult heavy stones, and dump large vats of burning tar over the edge. In the half-century since their construction, the Southron gates had never been scaled, never been breached. Something tickled the back of Raven's neck. A feeling. Something wasn't right. "Fire," she said. Her sister looked over at her, a grim expression masking her shadowed face. "The air is amiss," the Empress agreed, without Raven having spoken a single word other than her name. "They should have seen us by now," Raven said. "Their attention is elsewhere," Fire said. That's when Raven realized those patrolling the wall weren't gazing northward, but to the southwest. And they weren't moving slowly. They were running at full tilt, away from the end of the wall.
"What in the name of the gods?"
Goggin growled. A shout broke the silence, then another.
The line of Guanero pulled to a halt, scanning the wall. Had they been spotted? Raven wondered. But no, the patrols were still moving away, leaving this portion of the wall unprotected. She squinted into the distance, which was still cast in morning shadow, though the sun extended its reach second by second, its light gaining ground, revealing burnt red lands, and then...
God save us,
Goggin murmured. A sea of bodies churned in the distance along the base of the wall, like an insectile scourge pouring from a shattered hive. The forms were headed west, their path aimed at the exact point on the wall the Guanero were targeting. There were thousands, perhaps double the size of the Calypsian force.
Fata's slave army, Raven realized. He knows we're coming. Go!
Fire screamed into the wind. 37. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhone Lorraine. His sister's quarters, though lavish, smelled of fire. A charred mound of burnt books and papers sat in a corner next to a table and three chairs.
Leave us,
Rhea commanded the Furia, who had escorted them. Rhone was still having trouble getting used to their dark stares and blade-like expressions. He wondered if the red-clad women were capable of smiling or laughing. He thought not. The three women didn't seem to want to leave their queen unprotected with him, but they obeyed anyway. His younger sister wasn't what he expected. She was stronger, more commanding, though he still had difficulty looking upon her scarred face.
Brother,
Rhea said.
Rhone.
He was surprised, and he managed to meet her crystalline eyes, which sparkled.
You believe me?
Yes. You and your mark explain so much. Too much. Your disappearance, mother's death, the lies, everything. I believe you.
Then you'll help me.
Of course, dear brother. So long as you make no attempt to usurp the throne. We are kin, after all.
There was something off about her tone. Insincere. Then again, he'd only just met her. Perhaps this was always how she spoke.
What of the twins, Bea and Leo?
They are safe, she said, which Rhone thought was a strange answer.
Can I see them?
Eventually, perhaps. But this will all be very difficult for them to understand. They're still children. I don't want to confuse them.
She laughed lightly, though it sounded rehearsed to Rhone's ears.
Roth, it's confusing enough to me.
Rhone gestured to her face.
They say you cut yourself. Is that true?
Rhea raised an eyebrow.
You ask a lot of questions.
I know. I'm sorry. It's just... I never thought I'd be here. I never thought I'd meet you.
That makes two of us,
Rhea said.
Rhone nodded.
A question burned in his throat.
That man you executed.
She'd done it herself, plunging the knife into his skin. She'd killed him without hesitation. He couldn't imagine doing something like that.
Yes?
Who was he? What did he do to deserve such a fate?
Ennis Lorraine, our cousin. He disobeyed a direct command from me during the fight in the bay. He almost caused us to lose the battle.
Oh, gods. She killed her own cousin.
No, our cousin,
he corrected in his head. Rhone tried to keep his voice even.
Isn't sentencing him to death a bit drastic?
Rhea sighed. She rubbed her eyes, and for the first time since he met her, he thought maybe he was seeing the real her, the version that only appeared when she was alone, when her guard was down. Her eyes fell back on his, and there was great sadness in them.
I loved Ennis like my own brother. He was my most loyal supporter.
Then why kill him?
Rhone was trying to understand, trying to reconcile the compassionate girl he saw in front of him now with the fierce queen who'd stabbed her own cousin in the chest during a public execution.
I gave him a choice. Banishment or death. The law gave me no other option,
Rhea said.
Who am I but a hypocrite if I don't uphold the law? Ennis committed treason in wartime, a crime punishable by death. Offering him the mercy of banishment was as far as I dared go. And he chose death. Truly.
Rhea nodded sadly.
Evidently leaving the West was a fate worse than death to Ennis.
But there were no other witnesses, right? You could have pretended it never happened. No one would have known.
And then he wouldn't be dead. I wouldn't have had to watch you kill him. I would have known,
Rhea said.
I'd never look at him the same way again. I'd never be able to trust him. And I wouldn't be able to look my people in the eyes and pretend to be the righteous queen they believe me to be.
Roan, in a way, could understand that. His sister was a woman of principle, it appeared. He changed the subject.
Why did you burn these books?
He gestured to the charred pile.
They're from the archives. I asked for information on the Western Oracle, and it turns out my archivists were not nearly as obedient as I'd hoped them to be.
They tried to destroy everything.
Roan felt sick. They came all this way, and the very information they sought had been tossed in the fire just before he arrived.
Did anything survive?
I don't know.
We can go through it in a moment. First, I want to talk about your mark.
Roan worried he'd made a massive mistake in revealing his mark. He'd agreed with Gwen and Gareth that he wouldn't. And yet, as he had stood before his sister, his mark had pulsed in his chest. It had seemed to be telling him it was time. Still, he'd acted on instinct, without really thinking about the consequences. She could kill him on principle, as she had their cousin. The Furia could force her to act. He needed to find out whether the decision was folly.
"Don't you mean my sin, Mark?"
Rhea waved the word away.
"I only said that for the sake of my Furia. They expect me to act a certain way. I have a reputation to uphold. My people aren't ready for the idea that they've been lied to their entire lives."
Roan gaped. This was too good to be true.
"But what about what you said earlier? About obeying the Western law, about not being a hypocrite.
This is different. This law was based on a lie. The law needs to change."
Roan could feel his heart beating in his chest as he asked the most critical question yet.
"So you believe the marks have a greater purpose?"
"You could say that."
She explained what she'd learned so far. The marked girl, Shae Aris, who the Furia referred to as the Key, being taken south in search of something. The symbols they'd found, matching known fate marks. The map that showed the locations of other important documents.
"I read something about a peacemaker," she said. "I wonder who that is. I've already met King's Bane, and..."
"You have?"
Roan interrupted.
"Sort of. I haven't spoken to him. At the time, I was cowering like a pathetic little girl, while he killed half the palace, including Father. I'm rather embarrassed about the whole thing."
"Embarrassed?"
"Her father had just been murdered, and she was... embarrassed."
Roan said, "I've met Bane twice. I've spoken to him. I stopped him from killing the heir to the Eastern Throne." Rhea's eyebrows went up, and a flash of anger crossed her face.
"Gareth Ironclad. Why would you protect him?"
"Because I could. Because he's my friend."
Slowly, slowly, the anger melted from her face.
"You are a good man," she said. "I can sense it. But what does your mark do? What does it mean?"
Suddenly, Roan felt like this was all wrong, like he was trapped behind iron bars, locked in a dungeon. He spoke slowly, considering each word.
"I can heal people.
That's how I saved Gareth."
"Hmm." That's all she had to say? "Hmm?"
He was about to speak when there was a knock on the door.
"You may enter," Rhea said.
One of the Furia came in, glanced at Roan,
and then approached the Queen, whispering something in her ear behind a cupped hand. As the message was delivered, Rhea's eyes snapped to Roan's. When the woman had left, Roan asked, "What is it? What's happened?" Rhea waved the question away. "It's just Western business. Nothing for you to be concerned with." Roan had been considering something since he saw his sister, since he saw her face. "You know my mark, its power. I can heal your face if you want me to." The question seemed to freeze her, her eyes wide and unblinking, like a deer caught in torchlight. And then the moment passed, and she was the girl on the dais again, executing a man without hesitation.
"Why would I want that? I cut my face in honour of Roth. I am his servant."
Roan heard the determination in her voice. There was no point in arguing, not about this anyway. Perhaps later, after they'd become better acquainted. But there was another topic he needed to discuss with her.
"Listen, Rhea. We have a chance to forge a real peace across the Four Kingdoms. With my mark and my alliance with Gareth Ironclad, and your reputation as a righteous queen, we could—"
"I've been told Gareth Ironclad is missing. His brother, Gryon, has declared himself king. He's been amassing troops from all corners of the Eastern Kingdom."
"That may be true," Roan said. "But I know where Gareth is. We can talk to him together, create the first alliance between the East and the West in 100 years. We can do it together."
All the words he'd been thinking since he decided to finally return to Night's End jumbled together in his head, seeking a way out. He couldn't stop until he'd emptied his brain of them.
"We can change the way Westerners think about the marks. I can heal the sick and injured, show them the good things the marks can do. We can use my power to unite the kingdoms."
Rhea tapped her teeth with long fingernails. Roan was getting more used to the scars on her face now. They almost blended in with the rest of her, becoming a part of her. He might not understand why she wanted to keep her scars, but he couldn't deny the fact that they seemed to define her in an unexplainable way.
"You sound an awful lot like a peacemaker," Rhea finally said.
Roan couldn't hide it any longer. The truth was the only thing that could set him free. So he told her everything, start to finish. When he was done, she nodded, as if she'd known much of it already.
"You are the peacemaker," she said.
It wasn't a question, but Roan felt like he should answer.
"Yes, I think so. That's what Bane called me."
"The message I received earlier. It was from one of a dozen riders I sent south to try to recover the marked girl and the map. The rest are dead. Would you like to hear what she has to say?"
This was why Roan was here. To learn. To solve the mysteries of his past.
"Yes."
The woman was chained to a bed, her red clothing ripped, clinging to her skin, which was pale between the tatters, except where it was slashed deeply, all the way to the bone. She was convulsing, her eyes rolled back in her head. Roan turned to the side and vomited. Rhea stepped forward like nothing was wrong. She grabbed the woman's chin, forcing her to face toward her. Eyes still rolled back, body still convulsing.
"Tell me what you saw in the Dead Isles," she commanded.
The woman froze, eyes rolling forward, her gaze frantic and unfocused.
"The dead, everywhere. Not men, not horses, both. They killed them. They killed them all." "I don't care about the dead," Rhea said. "What about the rotting girl? The one with the rotting mark? Shae Arrys. And the map. Where is the Roth damn map?"
Roan wiped his mouth, shocked by the obscenity-laden outburst from his younger sister.
How did she become this way? "Gone," the woman said. "All gone. What about the girl's brother, Grey? Did you find him?"
There was desperation in her tone, in her eyes.
"He found us,"
the woman said, spit dribbling down her chin.
"What happened to him?"
Rhea said,
grabbing the woman's torn dress, pulling her face closer. The woman shook her head.
"Don't know. Dead all around us. I ran. They hunted me. Everyone dead. I made it to the boats, somehow. Somehow."
Rhea's teeth were clamped tightly together, her breaths whistling between them. She seemed to be fighting for control of herself.
"Is that all?"
she finally said.
"No. Found something else. Swallowed it. It's inside of me."
The woman's eyes rolled back, and she convulsed several more times before going still. Rhea reached out and placed her hand in front of the woman's mouth and nose.
"She's dead,"
she said. Turning to one of the Furia, she said,
"Cut her open. Bring me what she found after you clean it up."
38. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhea Loren. Rhone was alive and marked, and he was also the peacemaker foretold by the Oracle's prophecy. And Grey had gone to the Dead Isles. He had found his sister, and now he was probably... She refused to think it.
Has the world gone mad?
Rhea and Rhone had been going through the burnt documents for a few hours, waiting for the contents of the dead Furia's stomach to be brought up. Rhone hadn't spoken much.
"Good," she thought. "Let him be scared of me. I may need his fear soon enough." "I can heal your face if you want." Wrath.
The temptation was great. She could have everything she'd ever wanted back. Her beauty. And it wouldn't take away her power, would it? She would still be queen. Beauty and power. The combination would be unbreakable.
No.
She knew it would change everything. Change her. Change what her people thought of her. It wasn't until her face had been mutilated, her beauty stripped away, that she realized she never needed it in the first place. It didn't define who she was and what she was capable of. The scars on her face were the best thing that ever happened to her. "There's nothing here," Rhone finally said, startling her away from her thoughts. He delicately closed another charred book.
"Unless the important parts were burned," Rhea said, thankful for the break in the silence.
The break from her thoughts.
"Maybe," Rhone said, sounding frustrated. "Brother,"
Rhea softened her voice.
"Rhone, like you said, we are in this together. We'll find something."
Her words seemed to placate him, and he went back to searching through the pile.
"Wrath," she thought. "My brother acts like a puppy. Peacemaker? Ha! I could destroy him with a word."
A Furia entered, carrying a strange object. She handed it to Rhea, turned, and departed.
"What is it?"
Rhone asked. Rhea inspected the object, feeling the grooves with her fingertips.
"A sliver of wood."
Rhone frowned, shifting to look over her shoulder.
"It has markings," he said. "Words,"
Rhea said.
"In W.A., you shall find the truth."
"W.A.," Rhone said. "Western Archives." Rhea nodded. What else could it mean?
"It has to be here somewhere. The truth. A clue. Something.
We've been through everything three times. There's nothing here." Rhea considered the problem.
"The Western Oracle had to know that years might pass before anyone went looking for information on her. She was an outcast, sentenced to be burned at the stake as a witch. Even speaking her name in the West is taboo."
Rhone nodded, his eyes widening with understanding. "She wouldn't have hidden the clue in something that could be easily destroyed.
Check the bindings. Look for false bottoms. Anything where something could be hidden."
Together they searched, ripping books apart, tearing the bindings, cutting off covers. Rhea hit something hard, like iron.
"Here,"
she said. She peeled away the cover of a book, Fatal Prophecies, Volume 1, to uncover a small metal box with a basic copper latch. Her eyes met Rhone's, and he nodded.
"Open it."
She did, and a key rattled out. It was small, iron. There was nothing else inside the box.
Roan said. Look for another box. A while later he said, Got it! In his hands was another metal box, this one thicker, sealed with a lock.
Give it to me, Rhea said.
Roan handed it over, and she fitted the key into the lock and turned. The box sprang open. Inside was a single sheet of parchment, folded a dozen times to fit. She pushed down the corners and read what it said aloud.
Seeker of truth, find the hoard of knowledge, and find me. I am old, but I will see this land returned to peace. I will see prophecy fulfilled. I will die when it is time.
Rhea had the urge to destroy the paper.
This is useless, she said. It means nothing. More cryptic sayings than any soothsayer of the East could have spouted.
Roan didn't seem nearly as disappointed.
I don't think so, he said. It says she's alive, the Oracle. She must be, don't you see? The land has not been returned to peace, and her prophecy has only begun to be fulfilled.
Rhea considered it, still skeptical. If this woman really was as powerful as everyone said she was, and she really had created the fate marks, was it possible she'd found a way to extend her life well beyond a normal human's? Or was she human at all? It was said the Orions could live for 2 full centuries.
But she was burned to death years ago.
Maybe not, Roan said. Maybe she wanted everyone to think she was dead.
If she is alive, how do we find her?
Simple, Roan said, grinning. Find the hoard of knowledge.
We can search the Western Archives again, but I doubt we'll find some old half-burned woman hiding amongst the tomes.
Roan chuckled, and it made Rhea want to scratch his eyes out. She took a deep breath, letting the urge pass.
When did she become this violent person? When I killed Jove, she thought. When I realized how good it felt to hurt others. That strange mix of horror and excitement in the pit of my stomach.
What? She asked. The Western Archives are not the hoard of knowledge, not even close.
Then where?
Citadel, Roan said. Calip, not Night's End, has the largest library in all the 4 kingdoms. And it might not be the Oracle herself that is still alive.
Rhea frowned. Then who?
Roan told her what had happened in the Tangle, about the shape-shifting man-bear who had helped save them. If Bear Blackboots really is the Western Oracle's son, and is somehow still alive after all these years, we'll find him in Citadel.
Yes, she thought. I knew there was a reason I didn't kill my brother the moment I found him.
Rhea stood abruptly.
I will return soon, she said.
Rhea wondered whether she'd made a grievous mistake. If anyone discovered what she'd done,
my people will never trust me again.
And for what?
Love.
It was a word she struggled with more and more each day. She loved her cousin Ennis so much that she could never have killed him. It wasn't the same love that he had for her, but it was just as powerful. Ennis was motionless on the bed, his bloody shirt removed, leaving his chest bare. There was no wound save for a tiny cut in the flesh of his left breast. The shirt would be burned, all evidence of what she'd done destroyed. Before the execution, he'd watched her as she'd strapped the bags of sheep's blood across his heart. He hadn't asked what she was doing. He already knew. He had played his part as well as she could have asked, though she suspected his quote from The Brave Mouse wasn't part of the play. The poison on the tip of her retractable knife was called false death. It was extracted from the stem of a rare plant found only in the Tangle. She was surprised to find a small supply available from the apothecary, though she'd had one of her furia obtain it for Roth's business, so as to not arouse suspicion. The fast-acting poison stopped the heart and the lungs, sending the body into a strange stasis, neither dead or alive. A second dose, provided within a few days of the first, would usually reverse the effects. That's what Rhea was counting on now, by Roth's will. She threaded a hand behind Ennis's neck, tilting his chin back. She opened his lips with 2 fingers and dribbled the remaining false death on his tongue, then forced his mouth shut. She waited anxiously.
"Please," she thought, "I will never ask for another thing. Never, never, never."
He remained still. No breath passed from his lips or nose. She touched his chest, but there was no beating heart. Rhea collapsed on top of him and wept. His body jolted and he gasped. Roan Loren. Rhea had left hours earlier, promising to send up food, which she did. Roan ate the steamed vegetables coated in white sauce and left the roasted quail. Dusk fell while he ate, and he wondered when he would see his friends again. Twice he tried to open the door to wander about the castle, and twice he found it locked. On the second attempt, Ephuria opened it, telling him to be patient and wait inside for his own safety. "Who would hurt me?" he thought. He laughed, realizing the foolishness of his own question. If the truth of his fate mark became known, everyone in the kingdom might want to hurt him. He tried to be patient, rummaging through the burnt documents, but finding nothing additional of note. No more iron boxes or keys, maps or clues. He was certain everything pointed to Citadel. "We did it," he thought. He couldn't wait to tell Gwen and Gareth. Gwen especially, who would be thrilled to know they would be journeying to find the woman who gave them their marks. Our purpose. Roan was thumbing through a sheaf of parchment, mostly destroyed, when Rhea finally returned, still wearing her blood-stained armour. There was something more upbeat about her demeanour, a spring in her step. "I want you to go to Calip and find the Oracle, or her son, this Bear Blackboots character," she said. "You are from the South. You know how to blend in the customs." "I will try," Roan said, feeling giddy. This was exactly what he wanted. "When you find either of them, bring them back to me." Roan hadn't expected that, but he thought it made sense. "So they can teach us. So they can show us the path to peace." "No," Rhea said. "Bring them back in chains." "What? Why?" "They might hold the key to peace."
"Exactly, dear brother. Why would I want peace? I've decimated the North, and the East will never agree to an alliance, no matter what the Oracle or her son believes. The South? They are embroiled in civil war, ripe for destruction."
Roan could feel the horror on his own face, taste the bitterness on his tongue. A question formed on his lips. "Then why do you want them at all?"
"For their power, you fool. Maybe they can give me my own mark, a custom design with the power of my choosing. Perhaps they can even give me more than one. My Furia should have powers too. And if the sorcerer or her son are really still alive, then they also hold the secret to immortality. I wouldn't mind being immortal, would you? It's the only way I'll be able to conquer the Four Kingdoms. And if you're a good brother, I might let you live. Though first I'll have the Oracle or her son wave their magic fingers and remove your mark. I can't have you healing people all the time."
The sick feeling he'd felt earlier returned. Who was this mad woman? He couldn't believe she was related to him, to his mother, even to his father, who never tried to conquer the entire Four Kingdoms.
"Rhea, sister, this isn't right.
There is no need for more violence."
"Oh, I know," Rhea said lightly. "But I like it too much to stop now."
A thought from earlier floated to the top of Roan's mind. "Rhea, where are Bea and Leo? You said they're safe, but where are they?" Rhea smiled wickedly.
"Chained in the dungeons. They've been naughty. Can't have little demons like them running around, can we?"
Roan had no idea what to say to her.
Why did I show her my mark in the first place? Why did I reveal myself to her? Why didn't I listen to my friends who warned me against such brash action?
His fate mark pulsed in his chest, as it had before, calming him. Somehow, for some strange purpose unknown to him now, this was the path he needed to take. But that didn't mean he wasn't the master of his future.
I won't bring the Oracle back to you in chains. I will find her, but I can't do that.
Dear brother, but I think you will. Bring them in.
Two forms were pushed roughly through the door by a group of Furia. Gwendolyn offered him a dark stare and mouthed, "I'm sorry," while Gareth only shrugged. Both were in chains, stripped of all weapons. Rhone shook his head.
"We found them loitering near the castle gates. My spies in the city had already informed me that a man matching your description was seen wandering the city, asking strange questions about me. He had two companions with him. I assume these are the two."
There was no use in lying. Rhone nodded.
"This is the missing Gareth Ironclad?"
Rhea guessed.
"Your friend?"
Again Rhone nodded.
"Then who is this beautiful witch of the Iron Forest? Another friend? Evidently this armour of hers is somehow fused over her skin, though we tried to remove it."
What was Gwen to Rhone? A friend? More than that? Did the label really matter now? He said nothing.
"I see. Well, whatever she is, she put up quite a fight when we found her. King Ironclad, too. They killed over a dozen Furia before we were able to subdue them. The witch killed 10 of them. Apparently she moved like the wind. She wouldn't happen to bear a mark, too, would she?"
"Obviously," Gareth said. One of the Furia backhanded him across the face. Rhone stepped forward to help him, but two of the Red Women blocked his path. Gwen, even in chains, threw herself at their attackers, but two more Furia muscled her to the ground. Rhone said, "No!" and tried to break through. Strong arms held him back. Gwen raised her chin proudly, launching words between clenched teeth and a waterfall of silver hair.
"I bear the hero mark, something you will never understand."
Spitting out a wad of blood, Gareth said,
"Western hospitality is everything they say it is."
"Bravo,"
Rhea said, her eyes meeting Rhone's.
"Your friends are providing more entertainment than this city has seen in days. Isn't that why you declared your trade to be my guard at the gates? Entertainers?"
Rhone said nothing, his jaw clenched. He'd come here in good faith to be reunited with his sister, in the hopes that together they could change things. Instead, he found a monster sitting on the Western throne.
"What do you want from us?"
Rhea smiled.
"You have your orders. Travel to Calip. Bring the Oracle or her son back. In chains, if necessary."
Rhone could feel Gwen's eyes searching his face, but he didn't turn to look at her.
"And if I refuse?" "Then I kill the Iron Witch,"
Rhea said.
"Slowly. Piece by piece."
"She is nothing to me,"
Rhone lied.
Rhea raised an eyebrow, laughing lightly.
"You may be entertaining, brother, but you are no actor. You are in love with her. I could see it on your face the moment you walked through that door."
Rhone couldn't help but to look at Gwen now, to see her reaction. Her lips were tight, pressed into a line. Her yellow eyes a mystery. She said nothing. But Gareth's expression was unmistakable, as easy to read as a freshly penned stream message. Sadness, anger, betrayal. Rhone remembered their kiss, the way Gareth had reacted. He remembered their time spent together in the locket, how he'd awoken to Gareth sleeping in the crook of his arm. He remembered the way the beautiful ironclad boy liked to hide his true feelings behind japes and an arrogant smile. And he realized,
he's in love with me.
And despite what Rhea had assumed, it wasn't just Gwen Rhone was in love with. It was both of them. Rhone pushed down the thought, which made no difference to their present situation.
"What about Gareth?"
Rhone asked, turning back to his sister.
"What will you do with him?"
"The Ironclad will be ransomed."
"For what?"
"He's already the lawful heir, and his brother won't turn himself in."
"I don't want his brother. I want the iron-marked one. Bjorn Stonesledge."
Gareth scoffed. "He won't fight for you."
"Then he will die.
Either way, he won't fight for the East either. We all know he's your greatest weapon. Well, perhaps this Iron Witch was the greatest weapon, but she won't be much use any more.
You're evil, Roan said.
It was a pointless comment, he knew, but he couldn't help it. He was still shocked by how quickly things had turned against him.
Let Roth be my judge, she said. Take Ironclad to the tower cell. Give him a nice view of the East, so he can watch the destruction of his people. Haul the witch below. She can rot next to the twins.
Don't do this, Roan said,
as the Furia hauled his friends to their feet.
Please, this isn't you. This isn't what our parents would have wanted.
You know nothing about me, what I've been through. You abandoned me just like everyone else.
Roan, I'm sorry, Gwen said,
earning herself a final punch in the stomach. Gareth said nothing, though his eyes met Roan's. And then they were gone. 39. The Southern Empire, the Southron Gates, near Susa. Raven Sands. Hot wind gusted against Raven's face as they rode full tilt toward the wall, Ichnon's muscular shoulders undulating beneath her with each stride. She clung to the harness with one hand, her fingers aching, but strong and well calloused from years of training amongst the Guanero. Her other hand gripped her whip, trembling with readiness. Fire was already holding her sword aloft, flames kissing the steel. The other Guanero were equally prepared for battle, their weapons drawn and slashing through the air. Goggin rode no-handed, using his strong legs to clamp the sides of his steed, his hands clutching his dual scimitars. Several of the wall's defenders had finally noticed their approach, shouting a warning. Even in the dark, their white powdered faces were visible, almost glowing under the moon and starlight, like oval orbs of light. They dropped to one knee and fired longbows, but their arrows went long, splashing into the waters of the spear. They fired again, and one of the Guanic released a cry of agony, tripping and tumbling headlong, the long shaft of an arrow protruding from its neck. Somewhere beneath the beast, its rider was crushed as it rolled. Raven and the rest of the Guanera knew that stopping meant death. In any case, there was nothing they could do for their fallen sister. She had gone to meet the gods in the sky. Without a command, the Guanera closed ranks around their empress, creating a human and reptilian shield of leather and scales. Protecting her was the priority. As arrows continued to whistle past, occasionally hitting their targets, Raven glanced to the west. The slave army no longer appeared as ants, their features coming into detail. Only a few rode horses at the front, and their clothing appeared newer, cleaner. At least one was a dreadnoughter, while the others were a mix of Terrans and Phoenicians. Strange, Raven thought. The rest ran on foot, their skin as red as rusty iron. One of them fell, then another. Who is shooting at them? Raven wondered. She looked about her to see if any of their own archers had stopped to fire on the enemy. But no, they were all following Fire's command to charge the gates. Another volley of arrows flew from the wall, landing amongst the slave army.
They're shooting their own people, Raven realized.
That's when she noticed something else about the slave army heading on a collision course with them.
They have no weapons,
she shouted over the pounding of Guanic foreclaws. In reality, those on horseback were armed to the teeth, but the foot soldiers were clearly unarmed, being picked off by the archers on the wall. And the men had long hair, which was highly unusual for Terran slaves. Fire shouted back,
"They're trying to escape!"
The moment her sister said it, Raven knew she was right. This was no army, no threat. If anything, the thousands, whose numbers were decreasing under the barrage of arrows, were allies, in the sense that they had a common enemy.
"Do not attack the slaves," Fire commanded,
and several riders slowed to pass the message back through the lines.
"Bloody fools," Goggin growled, staring at the slaves as he rode. "They cannot hope to breach the wall without weapons."
Just as he said it, an arrow ripped past him. He flinched, and when he turned back to Raven, blood poured from his head. His ear was gone, ripped away by the force of the arrowhead. He grimaced and snarled,
"I'll take 100 enemy ears as retribution."
Raven didn't have time to respond, as the wall was approaching, so close now she could see the faces of their enemy as they sighted down their arrows.
"Archers!" Fire shouted.